Hello, everybody, and welcome to the next episode of Radiolab 201, the podcast from Benjamin Franklin High School. This is your host, Angelo Fernando, and this podcast is very special because I'm following up on a presentation we had in class from my colleague, Theresa Smith, of the English department, a former reporter who worked in the belly of the beast. She worked in Washington, D.C., and she covered stories in the White House and in Congress. So very interesting real-world experience. And why I'm bringing her on is this is a podcast for people in media and writing and publishing in my class. So this is so relevant because we're talking about stories and leads and all of that. So welcome, Theresa. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Glad
to have you here. First of all, some background. You're a graduate from Hillsdale College.
Yes, that's correct.
It has a great media center, correct?
The journalism program there is very good, and then they do have a very, very good but very small program. It certainly does a good job of teaching the students the basics of written journalism, and then they're even expanding their program to doing a bit of video journalism and radio journalism. They just began a radio program, actually. Many of the editors at the Collegian, the newspaper at Hillsdale, they had some fabulous internships in addition to the connection with the Media Research Center where I was a reporter.
Now, to get to what you talked about, or what I'd like you to talk about, is you talked about the art of the lead. I know, and very often we start anything to do with writing about understanding what is a lead. But can you talk a little bit about that, what you was mentioning about the skills you learned as a reporter to write a good lead?
Of course. As I mentioned to your students, one of the differences between writing in school versus writing in the publishing world as a job is that your readers don't get paid to read the entire entirety of what you wrote. And so the lead is the first piece of information, the first couple lines that your reader will read. The art of putting together a good lead would be to give whatever information your story is about. However, it also makes your reader want to read more. In order to do this, what I recommend, my technique that I learned, was to give the basic information: who, when, where, what happened, but then also pick something exciting from the story, pick a significant quote from the story or what somebody significant said, and make sure that's in the first couple of lines in order that the reader will want to proceed and read the details as you present them in the body of the story.
Okay, so the 5WH model, or the who, what, when, where, why, you're saying is important, but you have to input something that would more than convey that information, but incite them to move forward on the story. Because you're talking about stories that are written for print, not written for TV, correct?
Exactly.
Yes. So that's important because, as you were saying, you're writing to a reader or for a reader who doesn't get paid to read what you write. He or she can skip it. Now, you had some good examples, and I'd like you to talk about them, and I'm going to just go over some of these areas which you brought up because they are political and international. You talked about a story you wrote about the governor of Guam at that time.
Yes.
Then you also talked about something completely on the opposite end of the spectrum, about a biodegradable car. And I found that story really interesting because of the words you use and the kind of way of using what you just said about the lead.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were other things that you talked about, like the Michael Bennett story. When you covered that story, Like, this was a toxic story, right? At that time?
It was.
So, do you remember what your story headline was?
I used a piece of the quote from Michael Bennett, the football player, during his explanation to a reporter on why he knelt during the national anthem in imitation of Colin Kaepernick. He was saying to this reporter, I like hot dogs like every other American. And then to that, my editor actually added one word to make the audience a little more curious on what the rest of the quote, how the rest of the interview went. He added the conjunction but. So I like hot dogs like every American, but.
So you mean that was it? That was like a dot, dot, dot kind
of? There was a dot, dot, dot. And remember in online publishing and journalism, we're rated based on the number of views our stories get. So just that one conjunction made it a little more likely that people were going to click on that story. Not only does it mention a football player kneeling during the national anthem, but also making the audience curious in what followed and what the explanation was. So his explanation, teasing out that quote, was that he was insisting that he was a faithful, loyal, patriotic American, just like everyone else, but he did not agree with what he believed was an issue of racism in our country, and so that was his explanation. Now, during the summer of 2017, especially, when Colin Kaepernick and the rest of the football players were starting to kneel during the national anthem, it was such an explosion in the media. And so to see another significant football player following the same suit, and then his explanation of it, would ultimately made up that story.
Now, I want to go back to that. The conjunction was added by your editor,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes, it was.
Did you feel at that time like he was doing something that was sort of skirting the edges of honesty, or do you think that it was actually within the context of the story accurate?
It was certainly within the context of the story. We left it out of the quotation marks, so it was very clear to the audience that it wasn't something
football player said. So his statement was within quotes, but the but was outside of it.
Yes.
Nice.
Yes.
Okay.
So there was more to the quote. It was factual.
And we'll be right back in a moment. We covered a lot of ground, but I brought it back to that who, what, when, why, where type of question. And also asked her about whether there's some element of self-censorship that comes in. And she came up with a really great example that is very fresh. Listen.
I remember my first couple of stories as an intern. I would send them to my editor and he would send them back to me with a lot of red ink and corrections on it. A lot of what his questions were, or a lot of his feedback and the questions there were, how do you know this? Cite your source. How is this factual? Are you sure this is factual? So what I think was my breakaway story was one of, I wrote about Poland and something that the president of Poland said. During that story, it took me about a day and a half to write. It was a blog story where I included a lot of different research. And I decided with that story that instead of my editor asking me those, how do we know this, is this true, what is this, I was going to ask myself those questions so that he wouldn't have to. And so I just stepped into this
mindset
of an ignorant reader.
Uh-huh.
And I was able to execute this story with minimal feedback, and it was a very successful story on top of that.
I'm glad you brought this example because, you know, now this is the computer lab, you know, I'm not an English teacher, but very often getting into the mindset of the audience is important because students sometimes forget that they're writing for an audience, even if it's an audience of one. But what you're saying is what you, I mean, I'm sure your department, I know your department does this, you know, it's we're very big on citations and verification of whatever facts you're using. So in a sense, news writing is not different, even though it is from writing term paper or writing an essay or writing something, right? You have to verify your sources.
Very much.
You can't just pick and choose from wherever you want. You have to pick everything that comes with the source.
Very much so.
Because otherwise, like just like you're saying, your editor can question you or kill the story. We as teachers can spike the story and, you know, give it a zero if it's plagiarized.
Exactly. And so tying what the students are doing in the classroom and what the teachers are teaching the students to do, reporting something truthfully, writing something truthfully, even citing their sources and providing quotes from sources in research essays, giving the context of those quotes, making sure they're cited in the footnotes for the history department, cited in, on a works cited page. All of those things were in real life. Instead of me getting a zero as a reporter, the company would have been in danger of getting sued. So it's incredibly important on a small scale with the students, preparing them for bigger and more important things.
I just realized I need to share this story, not just the podcast. I need to share this story with my students, you know, at the beginning of the semester. Because very often I try to talk about real-world experience, and here is real-world experience. You can get a zero, you can get sued. It depends on what you can tolerate. So, you know, it's you might as well be honest and accurate. I'm going to play a clip for listeners about something you said about covering the White House.
During this year, during the President Trump's administration, the story I was able to pick up from this press conference was actually something that another reporter asked her. There was a leak from the Department of Justice, I believe, and they were asking her to comment on it. Her response, that reporter did not publish that response. But I picked up on her answer. I actually went and Googled her answer to see if any other sources were picked up on it. Nobody else did. It ended up getting a lot of views, not just from my news source, but other places. So developing that ear for things that other journalists may not pick up on is just golden opportunities to get a lot of views.
Not always do you get a chance to talk to somebody who's been in the press room or the room where it happens, as is now called sometimes. So I asked Theresa to expound on that a little bit more about the atmosphere and the pressure cooker-like situation. And she had some very interesting observations, and we'll end with that.
It was such an interesting dynamic watching the reporters who were quite mostly unfavorable to the Trump administration sitting in the seats waiting for their opportunity to ask questions, especially on such controversial issues. It was also quite interesting knowing that the reporters were there, packed into a little room, because they knew that the most significant person in the media, or at least the representative of the most significant person in the meeting, being the president, was going to provide them with a quote or a statement, and that was going to be their headline story for that afternoon or the next day. Because of that, I was telling your students how vicious reporters can be sometimes, especially in that room when they're competing with them among themselves to ask the question in order to get that story, and then also driving forward their own agenda that they are representing, be them from the right wing or the left wing, anywhere in between. Everybody's got an agenda to push, even though oftentimes you hear how the news should not take sides. Definitely, I would say most media do these days, and it was very clear from being in that room. So interesting and wild to see the dynamic between the press secretary and the guests of the press secretary and the media waiting and chomping at the bit to ask a question.
That's an interesting one. It's like waiting for a moment to pounce, as it were, because they're all competing for the same goal, the same red meat. And I must tell listeners that, you know, this is being recorded in April 2021. And Theresa is talking about being in the White House in 2017 when Sarah Huckabee Sanders was the press secretary, correct?
Yes.
So it's not really very long ago. And if you watch a press conference today, you know, the characters have changed, but the same dynamic is taking place. So it's interesting that not many people realize how competitive and what a pressure cooker situation you were in. You must have seemed like being a fly on the wall watching all this drama take place, right?
That's a little more accurate than you can, than just a figure of speech. Sarah Huckabee Sanders would not usually answer questions of the reporters who stood up against the wall. The main media sources had assigned seating in the audience. And I will tell you, when I went there, because there were such controversial issues such as healthcare, etc., being discussed, the place was packed, the room was packed, all the chairs were full. I stood with my mentor up against the wall and just watched the show from left to right and back again.
So that's so funny. I have so much more to ask you, but I'm going to wrap this up. The bell went off. That means the students are going to come pouring in for my next class. So thank you very much for being on this show, giving us that inside view of how the media operates, and more importantly, how we should think about writing and publishing in this digital age. Thanks, Theresa.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for listening in to another episode of Radiolab 201. This is your host, Angelo Fernando, signing off until next time. And next time will be a show about Alexander Hamilton, and also a controversial social scientific experiment involving electric shocks. See you then.